Hi, Rod Adams here, introducing show number 14 for The Atomic Show. It includes an interview with Ted Rockwell, a fascinating man who was a nuclear pioneer. I just want to apologize in advance for the sound quality. There were some intermittency problems with our conversation connection, and some of Ted's very important words are a little bit hard to hear. But I hope you enjoy the interview anyway, and I'll try to get Ted back on to fill in some of the details that we might have missed.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
Atomic Insights.
I'm very excited about this episode of The Atomic Show. As many of you that have read my blogs and articles know, atomic fission is a very new physical phenomenon when measured against its competitive energy sources. Humans have always known the sun and the wind provided useful energy. They've been harnessing falling water almost as long. Thousands of years ago, they learned that biomass and later fossil fuels would react with oxygen and release heat from combustion in a chemical chain reaction. However, it was a bit less than 70 years ago when man first realized that there was an atomic particle called a neutron that could enter in the nucleus of an atom and cause it to break apart. Heck, it's been less than 100 years since man first suspected that solid matter was mostly empty space with a cloud of rapidly moving electrons surrounding a relatively tiny, dense mass called a nucleus. Tonight we have a guest who was not there when atomic fire or fission was first discovered, but he was certainly there when it was tamed and brought indoors. Ted Rockwell was part of the Manhattan Project and was Admiral Rickover's technical director during the important early years of the Navy's nuclear power program. He's an old friend of mine and a man who is well-respected within the industry and has written several books and articles about the early history of atomic fission and about radiation and radiation shielding. He's even received an award for his book on radiation shielding, which is still, after 40 years, used as a basic reference text. Ted?
Yeah, 50 years, actually.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Was 40. But, Rod, I think it's very hard for a person today to get themselves in the frame of mind of 60 years ago when all this stuff started. And I want to try to do that a little bit because, after all, what we were handed was the evidence that you could make one heck of a bang with nuclear energy. But that was it, and this was a dragon that obviously had a lot of flame in his belly, but nobody had proved that it could be released in a controlled manner. So this was approached very, very gingerly, and everybody sort of took the extreme attitude that whatever we do, by golly, we're going to keep this thing under control. And we wanted to use, looking around to where one of the first testing reactors was going to be down at Oak Ridge, the materials testing reactor, the MTR, they called it, and where were we going to build that? And they set up a safety committee under a guy named Miles Leverett, and they looked around at what do you do with other kinds of dangerous activities, how do people protect them, what kind of assumptions do they make about the public safety, and so forth. And these guys came back white as a sheet and said, man, you have no idea what's going on out there. They said there are cities with 300 tons of chlorine in rusty old tanks upwind, you know, for processing the drinking water. If any of that stuff let loose, chlorine, after all, is the poison gas that the Germans proposed using and didn't in World War One. And incident after incident, these guys pointed out where they said, boy, we've got to do a lot better than that. And that's where they set up the idea of putting these first reactors in a remote site out in Idaho. And then later on, as they started talking in the case of the naval reactors, which were one of the first ones, We're going to have to bring them in close, and we were really going to have to make sure that they don't go off. Well, the premise that that sort of implies there, although it was never actually proved because it isn't true, but the premise that was hanging there was if this thing ever got away from you, man, you know, the whole world would become Hiroshima. And the people in the business didn't bother to argue about that, because what it did was that made everybody very careful to follow the rules and so forth. It was very fortunate that the first application of nuclear power was to a submarine. And submariners are used to the idea that their individual actions, when an emergency comes up, may mean life or death for everybody on the ship. If it's your job to close such and such a valve as fast as you can, when this emergency comes up and you suddenly hear the rig for collision drill or whatever the thing may be, you get to that valve and you close it, and the idea is that there's no arguing about it and there's no halfway about it, that it's done right. And so that attitude bred into submariners for good cause was put to good use in developing the sort of safety attitude that's needed for nuclear energy. Well, let me cut to the chase on the thing. The whole effort, as I say, has been focused on making sure that we never get a serious reactor casualty, and this is defined as something that causes some of the fuel to melt, and that would release some of the fission products, and oh man, you don't want to do that. And sure enough, we don't want to do that. So the whole attitude has been, when people talk about is this plant safe, the whole emphasis has been on the number of barriers we have between the fuel and the public. And when we get talking about terrorism, we know the number of guards we have and the number of guns each guard has and the whole idea. And when the public asks the logical question, yeah, but, you know, accidents happen. What happens if this thing gets away from you? The answer has been, no, we're not going to let that happen. And, of course, that's silly because it does happen. It happened at Three Mile Island, for instance. Starting, I guess, in the late 1970s, people started to look at the question of what happens if you do get some of this fuel melting. How much fission products get out? Well, it turns out that the fuel is a highly refractory ceramic material, and it's very good at holding the fission products in. Rod, you want me to just keep going on this?
Okay, well, I was just going to stop you and ask you a couple questions.
Okay, go for it.
You know, one of the things that I try to point out to people was that I agree with what you said about the fact that the first public knowledge of fission was really when they found out about the bomb. But the first time that we tried to build a reactor, it worked just as exactly as predicted by Enrico Fermi. He was able to start it up,
yeah,
and then shut it down and was well under control. Now, certainly that reactor was not designed to produce any useful energy, but it was certainly under control, as were the plutonium production reactors that were built during the war. Isn't that correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, you're right on that. But the point is that this public image had been built up, and it not only was a public image, but the way the industry operated sort of substantiated. Nobody wanted to talk about this accident, this meltdown. It must. And so starting about 1970s, they started measuring how much fission products come off of the fuel, what happens to it, how far does it carry. Well, we all know that the traces of it. Are you with us?
Yeah, I'm still here.
I hear some background. I didn't know there was any problem. That the trace elements that can go all around the world, and we can still measure, for example, in detail, the atoms that were involved in the atomic test by the Chinese many years ago. But that's quantities, and that's the significant point. We found out that dangerous quantities of fission products do not go. They tend to clump up and settle out. They precipitate out on cold metal. And so the final Einstein has demonstrated in Smile Island was that even if you got a core meltdown, and even if you had compromised, so we build these containment structures around so that if anything happens, but in fact, even if that containment was compromised, the mere fact that you hold structure around there and you got water and air, turns out the worst possible realistic consequences from any kind of a casualty that we can envision with a nuclear power plant, the few, if any, deaths. And the chairman of the Atomic, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the safeguard, have agreed with that. So that's a really important point. And despite the fact that industry has been told by their people, don't talk about the accident to scare people, the fact of the matter is that the accident in the worst case is still not a tragedy. It's not a big catastrophe.
Yes, I agree with that. And one of the logical arguments also that comes into play is if we can measure the trace elements of nuclear explosions all around the world, it's pretty obvious to me that there are trace contaminants from the releases from all of our coal-fired power plants spread around the world also. They travel on the same winds as do the trace elements from nuclear releases or nuclear explosion testing. But the only difference is that they're not quite as easy to measure.
Well, the interesting thing there, though, is, and this is one of the many paradoxes of nuclear power, that nuclear power plants don't really release a significant amount of radioactivity in the air, but coal-burning plants do, because uranium and radium are trace elements in coal, actually the amount of radioactivity released from coal plants is quite significant. Not harmful, but a lot more than anything that comes from a nuclear power plant.
There was a great paper that was done by a fellow at Oak Ridge National Lab. I can't remember his last name. Alex Gabbard. And he did, that's the name.
Right.
And, he did a study and looked at just basically on first principles and saw that the amount of radioactivity a typical coal-fired power plant of equivalent power to a nuclear power plant is on order of something like 100 times the radioactivity release to the air.
Sure. Well, you know, they've taken the public has taken so many of these characteristics of nuclear power, which are advantages, turn them around into disadvantages. You take, for instance, we always looked at nuclear power. One of the big advantages was that the waste problem was trivial. You had such a tiny amount of waste produced that you could put it in cans and it's still a tiny quantity. People say, what do you mean tiny quantity? That's 50,000 tons. That's 100 million pounds. You know, what's tiny about that? Well, the answer is that that's the amount of stuff, the waste that has been produced by 103 reactors delivering electricity to 20% of the American public. A fifth of the American public is, 60 million people. So you got this 100 million pounds distributed to 60 million people. It's less than 2 pounds per person. Total waste for that guy's electricity for a lifetime. You can put it in your basement. You know, it's a trivial amount. And you have to look at it in those terms. You could pile it. It's pretty dense stuff, but you can pile it in the end zone of a baseball field, football field, and I forgot the number, 10 feet, 12 feet high, or something. It's a trivial amount of material.
Hey Ted, I got a question for you, and this may be a little bit sensitive because you have a lot of friends in the industry over the years, but why do you think the electric utilities and other members of the industry have made such a big deal about the waste materials?
Well, there are two answers to that. One of them, of course, is the old follow the money, as Deep Throat says, and there's billions of dollars being made out of this. We talk about money being wasted. Money is never wasted. Money doesn't go down a rat hole. Money goes into some rat's pocket. And so there's a lot of money being spent. And so that's one answer, and it's a real part of the answer. But there's another part that's also real and much less cynical. And that is that when you go to put in an application for a new nuclear power plant, it's quite a process to get through the whole formal hearing and regulatory judgment on the thing. Years of time, millions of dollars worth. Now, if you say, I want to assume that this containment is not necessary, or at least the leak tightness of the containment is not necessary, or evacuation, massive evacuation is not necessary, because the data show that's certainly true, and I want to do that, boy, that throws a great big monkey wrench into the hearing process. All the antis are going to jump up and say, wait a minute, you guys have always provided us this protection before. You know, you're just trying to save money. We don't want to have you saving money at the cost of safety. So it throws a whole unknown negative factor into any licensing procedure if you go to introduce any of the kinds of things that we now know would be reasonable changes to make to overcome some of those extreme assumptions that were made in the days when we didn't know any better. And it's a real factor. I mean, the millions of dollars are ticking off day after day as the interveners come in and argue about, why are you introducing this new safety problem? Why are you making these plants less safe than they were before? So it's a very real dollars and cents and in years to an industry to take this problem on. And, you know, I can understand why they have that problem. What I don't understand is that when some guys at Princeton, for instance, made a study in which they said that if there was a fuel pool accident, if some of the spent fuel in the pool were to be hit by a terrorist or something, to drain the water out of the pool or whatever, and you get some meltdown there, these guys' calculations, it'll kill 518,000 people. Huge situation. They waived that report in front of the Congress. They took it to the National Academy. And the answer that the industry gave was, when the press said, what about this? You're really going to kill 500,000 people? The answer was, that's a very improbable scenario, which translates to, we don't expect that sort of thing to happen very often, killing a half a million people, 10 times what we killed in Korea, Vietnam, you know. So, they've been reluctant to, we've looked at the consequences of these accidents. Fact of the matter is, shown by a paper that 19 members of the National Academy published in Science Magazine, which is, you know, the peer-reviewed journal of record of American science, that few, if any, deaths would be expected from the worst realistic accident, assuming meltdown, assuming a compromised containment. They should rely on that, but they don't.
Hey, Ted, one of the other questions that has come to my mind, I haven't really figured out, why do some people claim that the spent fuel that is, as you described it, is a refractory oxide material? What are they used to claim that it could actually catch fire?
Well, what they're claiming is that the zirconium cladding would catch fire. And, of course, suppose it did even. It's oxidizable, as any metal is. But you think if you put a frying pan with an egg on one side and a gas flame on the bottom of it, iron is also flammable, you know, but the frying pan doesn't burst into flames just because you've got some heat on one side. So that's something that I think they just, you know, just throw in as assumption. And I should point out one other thing. When those guys testified before Congress on that report, and they gave their story, and then the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the regulators, came in and said these answers are not to be believed because they're based on unrealistic premises. And the authors got up all baby-faced and said, gee, what do you mean unrealistic? We took the same kind of premises that you guys take in these, you should pardon the expression, Sandia reports and others. And I said, they're absolutely right. This is not a question of knocking down one anti-nuke report. These ridiculous assumptions have been part of the game since the beginning, And we haven't really stepped back and put in what we know to be much more reasonable numbers, but instead they've taken these extreme speculations of what if it all gets out and what if it all burns and that kind of thing, without any taking into effect that the laws of nature and the properties of materials are known to us as well as they are when we design an airplane or a building or anything else. And we know that these things are physically impossible to get to that sort of situation. It doesn't take an operator's action. It doesn't take an automatic system to come on. The properties of the material itself limit how serious the accident can be.
I can bet you money that the designers of the 747 and any other large wide-body aircraft do not assume that one of the failure modes of the aircraft includes a section of the wing disappearing altogether.
Well, particularly, they don't assume that it happens over the the big Super Bowl,
over the engine
in the middle of a game, you know, plunging into the crowd. I mean, that's the kind of assumptions we've been making here. For example, the question of what happens to a shipping cask, and you know, it's called mobile Chernobyls and all this sort of stuff. And what you're talking about is ceramic clad in metal inside a big, thick, heavily constructed container. And these things have been literally tested by slamming a locomotive into them at 80 miles an hour, dropping them 30 feet onto a spike, all that sort of thing. They can't penetrate them. They finally found one way to impair the integrity of the cask. And that is if you can hit it exactly on the center line with one of these shape-charge anti-tank weapons. And if you hit it a little bit to the side of the center line, it'll slither off. But if you hit it just right, it'll knock a 3-inch hole in one side. So they did that. They mounted the thing on there so that it would hit just right. And whammo, they knocked a 3-inch hole in it. And so I talked to the woman who made the calculations how much of a problem that was. And she got a pretty high radiation dose, not a fatal dose or even a harmful dose, surprisingly high dose to the individual standing nearby. And I said, Ruth, how could you get such a number? She says, the rules I was given to calculate under, first, the whole thing takes place in a crowded city. We don't ship these casks through a crowded city, and we certainly don't expect that a terrorist would set up an anti-tank battalion system on the road exactly hit it right. But I said, okay, I'll buy that. What else? That's not enough. She says, the assumption that we're told to make is that after the event takes place, after the weapon hits, no one is allowed to move for 1 year. I said, come on, what do? You set up porta-potties and deliver these guys meat pizzas? And, you know, how? This is ridiculous.
You must stay in this place to receive your dose. Take your dose.
But I say that's the kind of thing I'm talking about, and to remove that kind of assumption doesn't safety at all. You get better safety by assuming that the world is entirely different than it really is. That just doesn't lead to greater safety. And in a case of emergency, you know, a terrorist dirty weapon or something like that, I was involved in an exercise and that thing was an academy. And the assumption that everybody's dying leads to panic that's completely uncalled for. All you have to do is, if the explosion didn't hurt you, dirty bomb, turn around and walk away. And if you're concerned that you may be contaminated, throw your clothes in the washing machine and take a shower. You know, and I broke up that patient by saying that David Gergen was running this thing, and he said, gee, you guys have got to do something. They're going through. People are going to be from the radiation. I said, David, nobody's going to get hurt from the radiation. You know, so assuming things are drastically worse than they are, lead to greater safety.
No, it doesn't lead to greater safety, because as we know from the study of the effects of the Chernobyl reaction, the mere act of scaring people and causing them to believe that they're victims, or forcing them to evacuate from their their home and live in different places and the stress is put on them, that's a health hazard in itself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And
you know, it's not much different than the health hazard of yelling fire in a crowded theater.
That's right. That's not an act of safety.
No, I think it's irresponsible for first responders and others to scare people instead of doing things that will help to protect them really and to ensure.
Well, take it one step further. I think the basic problem is that the assumption has been made from the beginning that nuclear phenomena and nuclear technology are somehow or other in a whole class by themselves. That the engineering knowledge and judgment and experience that we've developed working with other toxic and dangerous materials somehow or other is just never adequate for nuclear. And that, in a sense, takes all of our knowledge. It just isn't true that the properties of scale and the heat transfer and all the rest of it are just as true here in the laws of physics. Apply just as thoroughly here as any place else. For example, we say, why are you scared of radioactive waste? And the answer is, well, it stays toxic for years. And the answer to that is, what is the difference between a radioactive toxic material and a non-radioactive? A non-radioactive one, like lead and strontium and all these other things, mercury, selenium, those things stay undiminished toxicity forever. Forever. And yet, so here you've got something that is every day by day, less toxic. Somehow or other, that's put it in it, and it has, you know, it's a.
Ted, you still there?
How are we doing? Yeah, I think so.
Okay, I think we had a little bit of a blip there in my connection here.
I've been hearing some funny feedback. I'm not sure whether it's going to affect the broadcast or not, but it's some funny kind of feedback wanging in and out occasionally.
Yeah, we are on a voice-over IP system, so there's still some issues with that particular technology. Hopefully it won't be too bad for our listeners.
Telecon'd in via my own voice-over IP telephone connection, so that's a double win.
So we're voice over IP to voice over IP, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. I was going to ask you. Oh, here's a question for you, Ted, because I know you were involved and there. One of the things that's always been a little curious for me was that in the very early days of the Navy nuclear power program, your book and several others were released to the public and became standards based on the things that you were learning during the development of the early submarines, including the Nautilus and the Nautilus prototype. However, by the time that I went to nuclear power school down in Orlando, every document that I ever saw was stamped confidential, including a page of my training manual that the entire page was a discussion of the second law of thermodynamics. Do you have any idea when that change of philosophy occurred between helping people learn about nuclear power from the Navy and keeping it all a secret?
No, I don't, but I do know this, that Rickover was a very strong believer in classification. He says that this is a unique weapon, this submarine. We don't give away our weapon technology. But when he was told to take on the President Eisenhower's Atom for Peace program and build the world's first atomic power station, commercial atomic power station, he said, that's a different game. He said, if this is going to be any good to anybody, we've got to gather up all of this technology, evaluate it, summarize it, turn it over to the engineering code committees. It's got to become part of the day-to-day technology of the people who are going to work in this field. Otherwise, there's no point in doing it. And people couldn't believe that he was a very low-inertia guy, and people couldn't believe that he had turned around on that issue so fast. But he was absolutely adamant on that, and I had people come up to me after my shielding manual came out in 1956 and say, you know, gee, we were trying to get this stuff declassified for years, and we were never able to. How did you guys do it? And the answer was, you know, that Rick Over sat down with Jim Beckerle, who was head of classification, and said, look, if this stuff is going to be any good, it's got to go out to industry. And when he had Phil Kozlov, the number two guy from the Soviet Empire, visit shipping port, Kozlov had a camera with him, and he says, where do you want me to put the camera? And Rick Over says, take pictures. He says, there is nothing classified in this building. And that was a thing. I remember the word that went out to the people in the shipping port thing, I don't want any classified safes in that building. No, you know, no lockups for confidential documents. This is an unclassified technology. And he told Kozlov this in front of newsreels. He said, this is unclassified. You can take pictures or tell anything you want about it. Just like your Lenin is a peaceful project, right? Right? Guy said, oh, yeah, sure. And then, of course, they tried to keep Rickover out when he got over to Moscow after that. But, no, that was the big thing. A tremendous effort was made. We put out 13 technology handbooks. The reactor shielding manual was just one of them. Corrosion and wear handbook, the physics handbook, and so forth. To the basic technology documents, and they were all unclassified. Now, when that turned around and why, I can't say. I just don't know. I mean,
well, it sounds like maybe the things that they taught me at nuclear power school, people still thought was related to submarines, and instead of just being related to nuclear heated steam plants, which is really what it was.
Well, I think that's true. If you go up to the submarine museum in New London today, you can go through the steam part of the plant, and it's wide open. You can walk through it, and there's a tour that you go through and so forth. But unless you have a classified a Navy classification badge, you can't go through the engine room. I wasn't allowed through the engine room, although I spent a lot of time there in my younger days.
Yep, that's a little bit different, and you know, like I said, there's an awful lot about the submarine reactors, which has some very strong similarities to a 1950s steam plant.
Yep. Well, and the other thing, of course, is that we do know that the one thing that the Russians have had a lot of trouble with in their submarines is the fuel. And they started out with the idea that the air in the engine room was going to be kept a separate circuit from the submarine. And the guy on the BBC broadcast, when it became so radioactive, we decided to share it. And then he says, we ran the submarine until we got 100 times the permissible level, and then we surfaced and ventilated the ship and gave everybody 250 liters of vodka. They would spit out the radioactivity. Oh, ho, ho, ho.
Was that the K-19, Ted?
No, that was the first submarine. There was a broadcast in BBC about the U.S. nuclear program, and the Russian was side by side. And it's clear that they have never, up to the time that we know about, have developed a really reliable leak site. Okay, what else?
I was just going to ask about detail, but I had another question. This is kind of going a little backwards in the conversation. I was going to ask you, why do you think it is that the absurd assumptions that the engineers have been told to make concerning nuclear technology when they're calculating total possible fatalities, why do you think those assumptions have never really been declared to the public? Look how idiotic these assumptions are that we're having to make.
Well, if you see that science paper that we wrote in September of 2002 with the 19 academicians and authors, we point out that, you know, we're not doing that, and we point out one specific thing that we're not assuming is realistic. I don't think it's really a classification thing. I really don't know. I think there's still some feeling in people that they like to be part of something that's mysterious and dangerous and tricky, because obviously there's more money working on something like this than something that any old plumber can do, you know. And if that was used, it overtook the nuclear power. It's not just another subcontinent, and you can't use the same kind of techniques as quality control, because that's not acceptable for nuclear power. And it's not because the pipes yield any more easily in a nuclear plant than another plant, but the whole thing about the quality control, the welding, and all the rest of it is kept at an absolute highest level for nuclear, and I, for one, would sure never change that.
I'm all for keeping high quality standards in nuclear, but I also recognize that there are other industries and other people that maintain very high quality standards. You know, these days people are very concerned about products that last, and there's lots of other activities that are certainly at least as dangerous. One of the things that always, and as you are, I am a big fan of the accomplishments that Admiral Rickover did, particularly in his early days. But as a naval officer who got to be interviewed by an 81-year-old man back in 1981, I personally believe he stayed in the job just a bit too long and got to be very defensive, and certainly had, in some ways, the attitude, yeah, particularly in his later years, that he and only he had the intellectual credibility and capital to be able to manage what he considered to be a very complex environment, yet he trained an awful lot of pretty smart people that could do the job just as well without him.
Well, there are a couple of points in that, Rod. One is that his whole ability to maintain the kind of special quality control and, that he had rested solely with the fact that he was the representative of the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission for safety matters, not that he was an ET admiral, and that he therefore was in a position to decide who was qualified or not qualified to serve on a nuclear ship and all the rest of it. And you can say that was an absurd situation, but it really led to, I think, the situation that you got, that there was an awful lot of pressures from an awful lot of people that, you know, geez, we don't have to do this and we don't have to do that, you know. We can do it. We can cut a lot of corners on this whole thing. And so Rickover had to use that scare tactic and that l'état, c'est moi, Louis XVI approach to maintain that sort of situation. And I think, you know, I think our safety record shows it. I think it's, you compare other reactor programs around the world, and I don't know any of them that have done the job that the naval program has done. They've made 250 different kinds of reactor plants over their history, and, you know, have had sailors run them, and by golly, they still have never had an incident that involved any release of radioactivity of any amount. And that's pretty spectacular, and it didn't happen by luck.
I agree with that. However, I also believe in my heart that there shouldn't be any fossil fuel-powered large ships in the U.S. Navy, and unfortunately we have a lot of them that are vulnerable because of the fact that we never quite were able to institutionalize and share that knowledge and information about nuclear power with the rest of the Navy. There's an awful lot of very smart people who were offended by the idea of an ED admiral telling them where to go and what they could do with their ships, and thus decided that it would be safer and cheaper to, or easier to burn oil instead. And from a long-term perspective, that's not a, was not a good decision for the Navy. But that's my own personal feeling.
Well, but, you know, the road not taken is something we can only speculate about, you know.
True. But that's what I do. I speculate.
Okay.
Because I have no real control over anything. I just get to talk and write about things. Shane, do you have any more questions for Ted?
I'd just like to say it's been a pleasure to talk to you, and it's I've kept my mouth shut for most of the conversation just so I can listen, and it's been fun.
Ted, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us tonight.
The one thing I'd like to carry away from this is the idea that nuclear energy is an engineering project, and the technology is an engineering technology. And it's subject to the same laws of physics that engineers use everywhere else. And the idea is that somehow or other, you know, it's all spooky and different when you get to nuclear, just doesn't add up. And yet it's ended up by, I think, scaring a lot of people into a lot of bum decisions. And I think so long as we recognize that if you apply the same degree of quality control, it'll pay off in most businesses. You know, it really pays off to not to wreck your plant, whatever kind of a plant it is.
There's no doubt about that, and I can't let this go without seeing, particularly from a man who's been around the block as long as you have, how you feel about one of my basic core philosophies is that part of the reason why we are so afraid of nuclear power as a people is that we have been carefully told many, many times that we should be afraid because nuclear power scares the whatever out of people that sell coal, oil, and gas.
Well, I think that's absolutely true, and I think that it's caused a lot of bad decisions. I think no question about that. But there's one other factor. You know, one of the things that Rickover has been criticized for and the Naval Program has been criticized for is sticking to this old 50-year-old pressurized water steam plant philosophy. And why don't we go on to, you know, molten lead business eutectic like the Russians did and all that kind of stuff. And I have two points to make on that. One is, if you read the report of the Russian submarine program written by the guys who ran it, it's quite interesting. And they pointed out that Rickover had enough sense to abandon the liquid metal because it just didn't pay off, and the Russians didn't to their great loss. I mean, they've left ships on the bottom from Stockholm to Murmansk, and they've had some pretty horrible experiences. The other half of that story is that if you look at the sodium-cooled plant that we did build for the old Seawolf, the 575, that was a plant which thermodynamically was head and shoulders above the water-cooled plant. I mean, you know, instead of, I've forgotten all the numbers now, but instead of something like 24-degree delta T across the reactor, you get 580 degrees and a top temperature of 850 degrees, and, you know, thermodynamically, it was just a beautiful thing. So what does the customer, the captain of the ship, get out of this when he's standing on the deck? Well, it turns out he gets nothing at all for it. As a matter of fact, when we finally decided to abandon sodium, we put a water-cooled plant in that same ship and delivered the same horsepower because the sodium plant required tons and tons of shielding. It even had the little slippery problem that in the particular neutron spectrum in which they ran that plant, a significant fraction of the neutrons that were absorbed in 235 destroyed the 235 and made 236, but didn't produce fission, and so they didn't get any heat out of it. So that even from that standpoint, they didn't burn any less 235 in the ship, which is sort of ironic. And they had a ship that couldn't go any faster or do anything better, even though it was, from a designer's standpoint, it was a delightful step ahead. And yet, from the skipper's standpoint and from the customer's standpoint, they didn't get any more fighting ship out of it, and they got a heck of a lot of tough problems.
I can't agree with you more. I do have to say that at this juncture, designing a new system today, I think that the more straightforward application of some of the principles that led Admiral Rickover to choose a water-cooled reactor hooked to a steam plant in the 1950s might lead him to make a little bit different choice today, since a more common and more readily available heat engine is the Brayton cycle heat engine. But that's just, again, from my other side as a designer of closed cycle nuclear gas turbines. So, anyway.
Well, that's true. And that's the world is certainly different than it was in 1950, the engineering world. And you might come up with another answer. My only point is that the things which delight the engineer don't necessarily pay off in terms of the final product. And that's what you really have to look for.
Well, absolutely. And I'm all about a system engineer, and the only thing I care about is what's the power output and the cost to make that power output in a safe manner, because a good engineer is a lazy cheapskate who hates to fix problems that he could have prevented.
Right.
Ted, it's been a delight talking to you, as usual, and I hope that maybe after this you will learn a little bit about podcasting so that you can download and hear yourself talk to the people.
I'll check it out. I'll check it out. And we got through this whole thing without telling any funny Rickover stories. How did we do that?
I don't know. You want to tell one? We're not done yet.
Oh, there are lots of them. One of my favorites is when we were on a sea trials one time, and something happened in the reduction gear. It was not obvious what was going on, and the chief had torn the thing up, and they were looking there, and they weren't getting anywhere, and Rickover was getting more and more impatient, and he finally pulls the chief aside. He's getting his hands in there, and about that time, somebody decided to turn the turbine over by hand and mash Rickover's hand in the gears. And so he pulls his hand out, and of course, it's bleeding terribly. And they always had young doctors aboard the ship in those days, in the nuclear ships. And this young lieutenant was there, and he was trying to stop the bleeding. And it suddenly dawns on him that Rickover's had a couple of heart attacks. And he looks at him, and he says, "You're on blood thinner, aren't you?" And Rickover says, "Yeah." And he says, "You should have told me." He says, "That's irresponsible. You could bleed to death, and it would wreck my career," he says. And this kid was chewing out the admiral. You know, the admiral was sitting there with a sort of a quizzical smile on his face, you know. And his only concern, obviously, if Rickover bled to death, it was going to wreck his career, you know. "You know, I'm right. You're right. I should have told you." The rest of us were all trying to keep from laughing, and this young lieutenant was chewing out the admiral to come to. And it was all a concern about him. He was going to wreck his career if Rickover bled to death there on the submarine.
Well, you don't want to mess with the young lieutenant's career.
Yeah. Well, okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Ted. Take care.
Okay.
We'll be in touch.
Bye-bye.
Bye. I hope that you enjoyed this episode of The Atomic Show as much as Shane and I did in bringing it to you. Ted Rockwell is one of my personal heroes. He has made direct and important contributions to the development of nuclear technologies and has worked diligently to share his knowledge with the world. You can learn more about atomic history by reading one or both of his two books, Creating the New World, Stories and Images from the Dawn of the Atomic Age, and The Rickover Effect, How One Man Can Make a Difference. Both books are available at Amazon.com, and I will put links to them in the show notes. Those notes are available at atomic.thepodcastnetwork.com. You can also find out more about atomic energy by visiting Atomic Insights at www.atomicinsights.com and the Atomic Insights blog at www.atomicinsights.blogspot.com. Have a great atomic week, and hope you listen in again next time.
Hello, this is Patrick O'Keefe, host of the Community Admin Show on the Podcast Network. My show is the biweekly podcast for online community managers and administrators. We talk about community management, promotion, monetization, and more. If you run an online community, check it out at communityadmin.thepodcastnetwork.com.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.